Hi, this is Soraya.
And this is Jeff.
And we just couldn't wait to talk to you after finishing our conversation with Danny Bonnaire today. We covered so much material in one episode that we decided to split it into two. Here's part one.
Hello?
Hello, this is Jeff.
Hi there, how are you?
I'm doing great. So we're going to wait for Soraya to answer. Soraya, are you on the call?
I am. Hi, Danny.
Hi, how are you?
All right.
So, Soraya, it's 3 o'clock, so that means it's time to get started on a recording. Are you as...
I saw what you did there.
Are you as excited as I am for this guest spot?
Ridiculously excited.
All right, let's get started.
Sounds good. Hi, this is Soraya.
And this is Jeff.
Our podcast is called Paisley Stage, Raspberry, and Rhyme.
A podcast where the two of us play music that we like and share anecdotes and background about the tunes.
We hope you'll join our conversation. And without further ado, agrubiar.
Let's get groovy. All right, Soraya. So would you mind doing the introduction for today's guest?
Absolutely. It's my honor. And I really just want to get into it, so give me a couple of seconds here. Today we have as a guest an LA music legend from a number of different areas. One as a musician with The Quick, The Weirdos, Choir Invisible, The 3 O'Clock, and also from the other side of the business, music publishing executive with PolyGram, music marketing company, Natural Energy Lab, collaboration for music publishing with Burger Records Publishing Company, a promoter of LA music and of good music through the Danny Bonnaire Record Club, a champion of animal causes and animal rights, the ultimate LA Dodgers fan, and lastly, someone who grew up in my neighborhood in Panorama City. I grew up in Arleta. Ladies and gentlemen, Danny Bonnaire.
Hi there. That was way too kind of an intro.
Never. I feel like words fail me, Danny, with you.
All right. Thanks for the kind words.
So with all of that, I don't know how you had time to fit in a quick call with us, but I'm certainly glad that you did. And it came at a perfect week, because this is the week when the announcement came for the 3x4 project. And that's what we wanted to start off with, Danny, if you don't mind, if you could tell us how that all came about.
Sure. So in 2013, four of the Paisley Underground bands, four of maybe six, I don't know, we played a couple of gigs together. That would be the 3 O'Clock Bangles, Dream Syndicate, and Rain Parade. And while these were happening, me and Vicki Peterson from the Bangles and Steve Wynn from the Dream Syndicate just started discussing an idea of doing a record where the four bands played songs, each played a song of the other band and covered it. And I'd say for about, I don't know, a handful of months, we texted each other with enthusiasm, which then we went back to our regular lives and we forgot about it. I started to get to know Glenn Dicker, who's the co-owner of Yep Rock. And he's a big 3 O'Clock fan and likes the Paisley Underground bands. And I told him the concept, I guess, about a year ago. We went to lunch and I said, hey, it's about our little tiny scene. And what we're going to do is something I think is unique because it's not a typical tribute or a compilation record. We're each going to do, one song of the other band and it would be like 3x4. And he was like, yes, do it. Black Friday. And he jumped on it immediately, was very enthusiastic. And so then we had a period of time to record, and everybody went to their various producers, and we went back to Earl Mankey, who did Borough Codown and 16 Tambourines and Mondo Deco by The Quick, and Who, What, When, Where, Why by The Weirdos. So I've worked with him many times. And so we kind of went home to Earl, which is what we wanted to do many times, and that's sort of the crux of what it is, and we each did a song of the other bands, and I think that might make sense, I hope.
Well, I can tell you that Soraya and I are extremely excited about this release.
Yes. Well, I mean, us and a number of other people, as you can see by the amount of times that the original posting has been forwarded, shared, talked about, discussed, and all the other stuff that goes with it. Danny, I've got a follow-up question about that. Sure. So we know that Earl was involved, but what other producers and engineers were involved with the other bands?
I actually don't know. You know, I this isn't a big secret. You'll get it when you get the record, but I actually play on the Rain Parade's version of As Real As Real. I play tambour, which is, I actually play it on our version of it. It's a Middle Eastern drum, and they asked me to come and do the same thing. And I met the producer, but I really don't remember his name. And it was one of those things where it was kind of like, hi, and then all of a sudden we chatted for a minute, and then I was in a room doing the part, and then we were done. So I don't remember his name, and I don't, you know, somewhere I have all the credits for the record, but I don't have them sitting in front of me. I know I have a proof somewhere of everybody's two cents, but I'd probably have to start going through emails for 20 minutes to find them.
We'll save you that trouble. We'll save you that trouble.
It'll all be revealed in due time.
Nice. Yeah, that which is hidden won't be revealed.
Yes.
So we had a question about how you came up with the track listing. Did each band decide themselves, or were they assigned the songs? We know that each band was playing or recording a song from each of the other three bands, but how was that decided?
Well, everybody sort of said what they wanted to do. And as far as I know, I mean, we didn't have something where the songs we picked where someone said, oh, we wanted to do that. I can say in our case, we originally were going to do Mary Street by the Bangles. Uh-huh. And we used to play it in soundcheck a lot. And we started rehearsing it, and we all just said, it's just not working. And then we moved to Getting Out of Hand. And at first, that wasn't working. We tried it, and we sort of realized we can't kind of make this sort of sweet soul, you know, awesome female, you know, harmony track that we're not. We're not that little combo that they are. So then literally, maybe I'm just giving too much info, but literally Michael yelled something like about this British band, Amen Corner. And I said, oh, I've got it. So they were a British kind of like late 60s band who kind of did like pop soul. So we started doing it more like Elvis Costello and the Attractions' Get Happy period.
Oh, wow.
So it's kind of a bit more like that. I think we kind of go for a little bit more of a drive. And then while we were doing it, Earl asked me, like, after a take, he said, can you do this in the chorus? I said, yeah. And then that was the take. I mean, I think it was after the suggestion Earl had, we changed the one bit, and that was what we went with. And that was the take we used. But I don't think there was any bickering. I think the Bangles picked Jet Fighter, and I didn't hear anybody else going, I wanted to do Jet Fighter. So, I think that was kind of how it went. And I would say of the three songs we did, the one that's probably the most adventurous is the Dream Syndicate one.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
I think most people, if they like it or not, will see that it's kind of got a lot going on.
Wow.
I cannot wait to hear this.
I know. I'm even more excited for this now.
So yeah.
You know, I actually did try to get a hold of a label to see if I could get you something, but I couldn't reach anybody in time. But I'm sorry, but I don't know when they're releasing other songs.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Sure.
100%. We could have had an exclusive. But I'll take all the info around it. So Jeff, should we listen to the track that is released?
Yeah, can we do that? Do you mind listening to the one song that has been released, Danny, or at least released?
Not a problem. Play whatever you want.
Okay. Do you mind introducing the song?
Well, if I think it's what you're playing, this is the Bangles covering the 3 o'clock's Jet Fighter off the 3x4 compilation coming out on Black Friday.
Jet
so good.
So that's probably like the 20th time I've listened to that version right there. So
at least, right?
So at first I was married to Danny's drums and I missed that triple at the beginning. I don't know what you call it. And then at the end I missed the little double thing. So Debbie does fills instead of the little double tap. But now I'm totally used to it and it's great.
Yeah, they went for a different interpretation. I mean, ours is certainly built around the drum beat. And they didn't. They decided not to go for that or be using the keyboard riff. So that was, you know, making it their own. Yeah. So
I think that's what I think all of us are really just hungry for. Like, all right, how did you reinterpret it? And you know, what is each band's kind of mark on each song? Danny, I want to use this as kind of like a jumping off point because you talked about how Jet Fighter really is kind of. You know those drums. They're so symbolic of that song. Talk to us a little bit, you know, just walking back in time a little bit. How'd you get interested in the drums or just in playing music?
Oh, well, I mean, I don't know what led me to it. Very early, probably around first grade, I was interested in playing drums, and I was in orchestra in first grade, but all I had was a practice pad, I think. And I decided after 1 year, I was really just bored of it. So I moved to guitar and I moved to piano. And in both cases, I just got bored. I don't know why. I mean, it was just it's one of those things where you sort of wonder, why do you want to play drums? It's a ridiculously, you know, big pain. But I gravitated back towards it. And then my father went out of the country and my mom bought me a drum set. And so, you know, I was like little Ricky with my drum set at, you know, like, I don't know, 12 or 13 or something. And I sort of beat a lot of my friends to a piece of equipment by about 6 months. And I certainly do have a lot of horrible tapes of us jamming as kids, you know. So I guess it was just like I just kept going back to it, and that was sort of it. I don't know, and I think I like that, you know, the kind of response. I think the same thing happens on guitar. There's a magical response if you bash on something or you know, play big chords. And but at first it was nothing like that. It was just like, you know, playing one beat for a while. But I guess that was it. And you know, slowly but surely, I had a brother 5 years older than me, and you know, he was a big influence, and he was buying records, and he was liking more like Dylan. He liked the Beatles, but I think I was liking more like weird British bands. And so slowly but surely, I think that just graduated into me finding that all exciting, you know, probably what led me there.
Wow. Hey, speaking of your brother, you've posted on social networking sites that you and your brother attended the Altamont concert with the Rolling Stones. And not only that, you guys were really close to the Meredith Hunter situation. From the pictures, it looks like you're like right in that proximity.
Yes. My late brother, Jonathan, he made a decision, I think, less than 24 hours before that we were going to go. Wow. Since he didn't need tickets, it wasn't that big of a deal. And so we headed up, and it was his girlfriend and his friend David and myself. And about three quarters of the way there, he hit a rock, and it busted his pipeline in the city of Tulare.
Oh, wow.
And I remember it was about 5 in the morning, and we had to wait till like this gas station opened till 8. So we got this really late start to getting to Altamont. So by the time we got there, it was more noonish, and we parked and started walking. But little did we know, we came in through the backstage.
Oh, wow.
So all of a sudden we walked up, and we were, if you were on the stage, we were on the left side, and we just sort of walked up, and that was sort of where we were. And and then, you know, right at the beginning of the Stones, I mean, we were there for the whole event, but right at the beginning of the Stones, the Hell's Angels had motorcycles in front of the stage, and one of them fell over and they started charging the crowd. And actually in the film, there is, I've seen it. First of all, I fell down and people were stamping on me.
Oh my gosh.
My brother pulled me up and we ran. I actually have seen myself in the film because I watched it on video on YouTube. And, so then it was a scary, and my brother and I went to the back and jumped on the stage, and they kicked my brother off, and I stood on the amp line of behind Keith Richards and Mick Taylor's amps.
Oh, my gosh.
And I just stood there. I was so young that, you know, nobody was going to bother me. It was like my brother was, you know, just the right age to hassle. And so when the set was over, I looked over at Charlie Watts, and he had this crushed velvet jacket next to his four tom, and I tapped him on the shoulder and asked for his drumsticks, and he gave them to me.
Oh, my gosh.
And then, like, 2 weeks later, the Rolling Stone issue came out about Altamont, and there was this photo of three people, a white blonde-haired chick, an African-American, and they were both sort of dancing and celebrating, and then with his curly hair and his wire-rimmed glasses looking straight in the camera with my brother.
Wow.
So that was just crazy. So he's in the Altamont issue, which is kind of awesome.
Wow.
In the book that came out about half a dozen years ago, the guy who photographed the whole tour, I looked at the book, and on this one page it said, it's kind of a photo of the stage from Keith, from the back, with Keith Richard, his arm in the air, and it says Meredith Hunter is in green. And I looked up and I counted up, and there was Meredith Hunter on the left, and about two rows in front of him were the four of us. So that was just crazy. I'd never seen the photo, and it was just sort of like, yikes, there I am.
That's amazing. So,
yeah, it's all true.
Wow.
Moments in music history. Now I want to find this book and I want to see this photo.
Yeah, I can see it. Well, hold on 1 second. Chat amongst yourself for 1 second.
Okay, so just.
It's called Let It Bleed. It's a giant book. It's a giant book. It's called Let It Bleed. I couldn't see the photographer's name, but if you look it up, it's basically the whole 69 Stones tour, but the book weighs about 45 pounds.
Dang.
I mean, it's heavy. And, you know, so it sort of breaks down the whole tour, but there's a huge swath on Altamont.
Wow.
There are so many stories. That 69 tour, I mean, there's just so much to talk about. And now I need this book. Thank you, Danny. Thank you for looking it up in your library. Now I need this book.
You can work with somebody with it. That much I could tell you.
Okay, Danny. Now I want to switch a little bit to some of the bands that you were involved in, and I want to talk about The Quick. Sure. So, for those listening, there was an event in June of 2018 where members of The Quick came together, and it was a discussion about the making of Mondo Deco. But can we just backtrack for a second? Can you talk to us a little bit about how The Quick comes together?
The Quick comes together. It was the first band I was in, and I went to both junior and high school with Stephen Hufstead, who was the guitarist and songwriter, and we sort of became like, you know, over time, like professional garage musicians. Nice. We just rehearsed and played with various people, from Kevin DeBrow and Quiet Riot to,
wow,
you know, friends, just various friends. And slowly but surely, you know, at first it was Steve was, as we got better as musicians, Steve first was sort of an interesting arranger. So I remember kind of the first moment I realized that was he took the Kinks song Till the End of the Day and married it to Love's Seven and Seven Is. And that was sort of the moment I started realizing, wow, he's doing something other than us just jamming on, you know, whatever. And then he started writing kind of early versions of songs and ideas, and they weren't great, but he was writing songs, which nobody else was. And then in about 74, I think we became, you know, serious, and we slowly started forming the band, and we sort of went through, a lead singer and about our original keyboard player, Billy, was in for a little while, but he didn't have a keyboard, so he was out. And we sort of went through this, you know, revolving circle of keyboard players. And then Ian, our bass player, joined in, I think, 1974. And so the three of us trudged on like, you know, sad little pros, little kids trying to be in a rock band. We knew nothing. And then I think in late 75, we went to school with Danny Wilde, and Steven ran into him, and we'd seen Danny play in his band Kix, which had two members of the Dickies, Carlos and the drummer, and Chuck Wagon, whose name was Bob Davis, the late Bob Davis. And Danny was trying to be David Bowie and Mick Ronson, and we played at our high school gym. And Steve just approached him, and like Danny's like, yeah, I'll do it. And so Danny sort of jumped in before we really had anything other than we'd gone through a slew of songs and where Steve was writing a lot. And that sort of led us to Kim Fowley by some weird circumstance. And he got involved in the beginning of 76. And within about 4 months, we had a record deal, which I never understood and can't understand. And you
know, that's insane.
Yeah, there was no internet to go on and figure out what the hell we're doing right or wrong. And we cut demos 5 blocks from my house. It's still there, the studio. It's where the Runaways recorded their first album. And that's sort of it. And we ended up making this album, Mondo Deco, that was this kind of this weird cult record for many years. And it led me to Earl Mankey being a Sparks fan. And he worked at the Beach Boys studio, and we ended up making the album at their studio, which was a very, very unusual experience. We kind of controlled their own studio, and Dennis Wilson was recording Pacific Ocean Blue at 3 a.m. And
wow.
So it was fascinating. And I mean, I have a lot of love for the band, and we put, you know, the album got reissued for the first time earlier this year, as you mentioned. And we, for about 2 years, you know, tried to kind of, you know, do something, but we probably did everything wrong. And we went down in glorious flames, which if you're going to go down, that's the way to do it.
That's the way to do it. Yes, indeed.
So for anyone listening, you need to pick up this reissue. It is absolutely worth your time to sit and listen. And like Jeff mentioned earlier, I think I've listened to it so many times that now I'm starting to pick up on the little nuances in different songs. Jeff, let's play a little something. I want to hear No No Girl by The Quick.
Alone with your toys on the floor. You've been so good and they don't even see. If you were bad, you'd be on daddy's knee. Little girl lost who was often ignored. Grew into a teenager frequently bored. Found out the bad things most often feel good. And then tried as many of them as she could. Still. shocking, but nobody cares. She tries to be dangerous, but no one's aware. She is still after her lost relation, a classic case of father fixation. Daddy was good, daddy was just, daddy was God, in dad you could trust. So when you were bad, he knew what to do. But now there is no one who cares about you.
Good.
Yeah, so I can definitely hear Bowie in there, that influence. And I did want to say that those drum heads feel like they got punished on that recording.
Yes.
Well, I was young, and I was young and I probably hit hard.
Yeah.
I can tell you something that I don't think I've ever told anybody, but in that song, there's a lyric, she's still after her lost relation, a father case of something, whatever, but there's a lyric, she's still after her lost relation. But Danny Wilde says she's still after her lost volation because Steve's R's looked like V's. I was listening to it now. I was like, oh yeah, he says volation. It's not even a word. It's great. And hope he fixed it. But yeah, Steve had the lyrics. You know, he was in a vocal booth, and the lyrics were sitting in front of him, and Steve's handwriting was about as bad as mine. His R's were V's, so it was awesome.
That's hilarious. So you said you guys went down in flames. So after the Quick, is that when you joined the Weirdos?
No, my life story, it's not that interesting, but we go on for a while. We did a lot of stuff at Elektra, which got released later on. Song Pretty Please got covered by Red Cross and Dickies. And it just didn't lead to a deal. And we ended up breaking up sort of the summer before the new wave scene happened in L.A. And I ran off to England. And saw like tons of stuff. And almost joined a few bands. I played on a record and, did lots of weird things and kind of almost would have joined a band, but Don Arden wouldn't pay for my visa, so I didn't. I came back and I formed another band with Steven called The Falcons, and we were sort of a blue-eyed soul band. And we recorded a bunch, never released anything. Mickey from 3 O'Clock was in the band.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, the original singer of the Quick was in it, and my friend Billy Persons was the bass player. He kind of looked like Eddie Cochran, so he had this kind of marvelously great look. And we sort of trudged on for probably a bit too long, and somewhere in the middle of it, I think Lisa from Frontier Records said the Weirdos are making a record and they need a rhythm section. And Billy and I were like, yes, we'll do it. So I coughed up my parents' garage and I coughed up Earl Mankey to them. And we went and recorded this EP with the Weirdos called Who, What, When, Where, Why. And after we finished it, Billy and I, it's a silliness. I've always been very loyal to the band I'm in. But we went and rehearsed at least once, maybe twice with the Weirdos. And we were like, we can't do two bands at once. What are we thinking? And which was just dumb. So we just sort of left the Weirdos in behind, and they kept going. And we stayed with the Falcons, which, there wasn't any real reason. It wasn't like we were on Epic Records and had a 4-album deal or something. So, that led us to, for me to be in the Weirdos for one record. It took a little bit of time to get there, but yes, I was.
Do you expect that the Falcons material will ever be released?
Probably not, but I couldn't say for sure. There are reasons, and
yeah,
some of them just not public reasons.
Right.
But yeah, there are some stuff. There are some you know tapes that exist. I think Mickey has some, but absolutely, you know, that there are some, but I wouldn't probably bet on it.
All right, I won't hold my hopes too high.
Yeah, you'll survive.
Yeah, I'll survive. All right, but I did want to play a song by the Weirdos, if you don't mind. Speaking of drums getting punished, so yeah. From Who, What, When, Where, Why by the Weirdos, this is Happy People.
Them drums, man.
I love the drums in that song.
Oof.
Thank you.
Danny just going to town. So, Danny, then how does Choir Invisible work into this trajectory?
I'm trying to think. How did it... after the Falcons, which was really what I was in, there was this LA band called the Flyboys, kind of a pop punk band, and Lisa put out their first EP at Frontier, and they broke up, and she wanted them to still be a band and got me involved, but it was sort of, we did this sort of, I don't know, she thought, I guess, it would be this great strategy. So we did something backwards. We went and recorded a record with Tom Wilson, who would not use his name on the Salvation Army album because he thought it was so embarrassing. The late Tom Wilson, and not the one who worked with Bob Dylan. We made this record, and we were sort of this new romantic band. I mean, it was kind of heavily leaning probably on Magazine and Susie and the Banshees and things like that, except that we were all men. Then we sort of went out and hyped it, and I think the first gig we did was the Whiskey A Go-Go, when it was sold out, and it was like this big deal because it was sort of like we came out of nowhere. And then I think we did a gig with the Simple Minds. And did a disastrous tour of the United States. Oh, no. Disastrous in Winnebago, living on $5 a day.
Wow.
Came back to LA, and the last gig we ended up playing, I recommended Dream Syndicate to open at the Whiskey.
Oh.
And it was the night I met my wife. So there you go.
Wow.
So,
yes.
Something good came out of it. And then within days, I wasn't in Choir Invisible anymore.
That's a good story. I like that.
Well, you know, it works for my wife and I. But
Excellent. Should we play a song by Choir Invisible?
Sure, if you want. It's your show.
If it's our show, we're playing The Other Room. This is by Choir Invisible from their self-titled album featuring Danny Vanier on drums.
Among your faults, I can't decide. But as I wandered outside to a different one who wants to be, I do. Think about the other room. I'm still waiting.
So apparently in the other room was Danny's future wife.
See?
Well, yes, I mean, you know. But yeah, it's weird. I haven't heard that in a while. And some weird timing on that stuff.
Yeah.
Our lead singer, John Curry, had the best hair. He worked very hard on it, and it wasn't something easy. But he made his hair calico.
What?
Think about that
wow.
for a second.
I'm trying.
And it wasn't a shoddy job. It was an amazing job. He had calico hair.
Wow, that sounds awesome, actually.
Yeah, it was actually very impressive. I still remember that to this day.
I wonder if there's any photos of that. I need to see that.
I think there are. Maybe they're even on his Facebook page. But
wow.
They have to be somewhere.
Yeah.
Good.
Hey, Danny, so you mentioned that Lisa Fancher of Frontier Records was instrumental in getting you the deal or working with the Weirdos. And we wanted to know how the relationship with Frontier Records came about. Was that because she was the president of the Quick Fan Club?
Sorry, I had to close the door. It was kind of noisy here. Sorry, repeat that question. I'm sorry.
So we were wondering how your relationship with Frontier Records came about. It seems like there's quite a few Frontier records that
After I got to know Lisa, we dated for a period of time. And then when we didn't date, we still were friends. And me and a couple other people, including her, almost started a record store.
Oh.
Instead, she started a label. And so just as time went on, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, she brought up the Choir Invisible thing. And, you know, she was slowly but surely signing bands probably on a shoestring budget. You know, I know even then it wasn't easy making records if you were an indie.
Mm-hmm.
She's got some great stuff on that label. There's a lot of great releases on there.
Yeah. Very much so.
So then, you know, we've been hearing all these different sounds, different fans. So then how does the 3 o'clock come to you?
Well, basically what happens is, I think I'm coming back from seeing The Damned, and I put on Rodney's show. It was like a Sunday night, and he played Bun Gardens. And I freaked out. I had never heard anything like it, and it sounded like, you know, Pete Shelley of the Buzzcocks fronting a psychedelic band. It was this very odd mixture, a song style that I'd never heard before or since. It was very unique. And I called Lisa, and she'd heard it, and she was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And I was like, it is. And then they didn't have a record deal. They just had a one-off single on SST through D. Boone of the Minutemen. And then she signed him to a record deal. And kind of what happened was, somewhere in the middle of it, when I was still in Choir Invisible, she invited me down one night to see them record. I think I'd already seen them live, but I'd never seen them, you know, I'd never met them. You know, and so I came in and, you know, I met Michael and Lewis. I met the three of them and Tom Wilson, and he was very unhappy with how things were going. And he just didn't get into it. I remember Michael was writing lyrics on giant parchment paper. And I remember they worked on She Turns to Flowers. And the whole melody and everything stuck with me when I left to go on the road. And I remember they did While You Were in Your Room Talking to the Wall, and Lewis doing the keyboard solo while I was there.
Wow.
So I saw them record a couple songs. I think they also worked on Grimly Forming when I was there.
Great song.
And I loved it. And I just thought, you know, they were cool little kids. And, you know, I went away. And then I came back and they did the Choir Invisible thing, and it ended. And then a couple weeks later, I guess Lisa said, you know, they kicked Troy out of Salvation Army. And, you know, I've told them they should talk to you. And I'm like, okay.
Make sure to listen next week for the conclusion of our conversation with Danny Bonnier.
I think we would be remiss if we didn't mention that one of the Paisley Underground bands, the Dream Syndicate, is going on a short tour. They will be playing 5 shows here coming up. So if you're in any of these areas, please check them out. On October 16th, they'll be playing the Wonder Ballroom in Portland, Oregon. October 17th, the Neptune Theater in Seattle, Washington. October 19th, the Fillmore in San Francisco. October 20th, at Harlow's in Sacramento, and their last show will be October 21st at the Fonda Theater in Los Angeles. You'll find me there. After that, I understand that Steve Wynn will be doing some solo shows in Europe, so he's going to be leaving after that. And I did want to mention one last thing, and that's that Michael Quercio's post 3 o'clock band, Permanent Green Light, has a compilation coming out on Omnivore Records. It's going to be called Hallucinations. That comes out October 19th. So make sure you pick that up. It's going to be amazing. I'm super excited for that.
Yeah.
And that's all that we have for news.